and welcome to Switchblade Sisters, the podcast where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. Every week here on the podcast, we invite a new female filmmaker, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about their favorite genre film, maybe one that influenced their own work. I'm film critic Katie Walsh, and today we have writer-director Tara Mealy. Welcome.
Hi. How's it going, Katie?
Good. I'm so glad you're here and that we are going to talk about your film, Wander Darkly, and also the film that you've chosen for today. But first, I am going to read a bio about Tara so we can all get to know her. Tara Mealy is a Long Island native and California transplant who works as a writer and director both in film and television. Tara's most recent film, Wander Darkly, starring Sienna Miller and Diego Luna, premiered in U.S. dramatic competition at the 2020 Sundance Film Festival and was distributed by Lionsgate. Tara is well known for the viral video Meet a Muslim, which she created to combat Islamophobia, and which has been shared around the world over 45 million times. She has directed episodes of Arrow, Batwoman, and Hawaii Five-0, as well as four micro-budget feature films. She is currently attached to write and direct a film adaptation of Carol Burnett's memoir, Carrie and Me, which will be produced by Tina Fey. So, Tara, today you have chosen to discuss the 1990 film Ghost.
Yes.
Can you tell us why you chose Ghost?
So, you know, it's funny. I had heard recently that it was a 30-year anniversary of Ghost, and I realized that A, that makes me like super old, and that B, I haven't seen it in 30 years, but it was like seminal to me, like as a child, and maybe just Patrick Swayze as a young, you know, blossoming
woman.
Well,
Patrick Swayze.
We can get to that.
He's very influential.
There's a shot where he like jumps through the door, and I was like, such a good dance move. Like he does it, it's like such a dancer. I have heard some comparisons recently of Wander Darkly to Ghost, and I hadn't seen it in a really long time. And I was like, oh, maybe I should like watch it again. And so it was a good excuse. When I was thinking about what to do for Switchblade Sisters, I was like, what do I actually want to like watch this week? And Ghost felt like just what I needed. And here we are.
Yeah. I had not seen it since the 90s, and it's so entertaining. I was really surprised. I think, you know, it kind of has a reputation of being a little bit cheesy now,
yeah.
But it's so well made, and it actually really nails this very difficult tone of being romantic and a thriller and funny.
It's
and
so many things.
Yes, it really, really is.
Yeah.
And I did also, when I was watching Wander Darkly, I was like, okay, this is the 2020 Ghost, which is
I'm into that.
That it's much more emotional, philosophical, you know, heady kind of approach to what it means to reckon with your life and your relationships in the afterlife.
Yeah.
Whereas Ghost felt a lot more straightforward.
Good versus evil, you know, like.
Yeah, it's about like, okay, I have to save the girl from the afterlife. And, you know, you can also tell that it's very much about the new technology and in creating these ghost figures and like you said, Patrick Swayze like jumping, you know, onto the subway or something.
Totally.
Like that. Like, wow.
What's his like superhero ghost training montage? Like how does he like learn how to push the penny or like push the sneaker off of the garbage can? You know, it's like so sound effects.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But your film doesn't really have so much technology. So it's more about like the inner experience of what that might mean or and how that might look like. So I'm excited to dive into your film. But first, before we do that, I am going to give a little synopsis of Ghost.
Okay.
Also a spoiler alert. So for those of you who haven't seen Ghost, you've had 30 years to do
I'm
so.
Sorry. It's over for you. Yeah.
But today's episode will contain spoilers that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. Like we always say, it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause this episode and watch it, now is your chance. So, Ghost. Written by Bruce Joel Rubin, directed by Jerry Zucker, the 1990 romantic fantasy thriller, again, like so many genres, Ghost stars Patrick Swayze, Demi Moore, Whoopi Goldberg, Tony Goldwyn, and Rick Avilés. Made on a $22 million budget, the film grossed a whopping $505 million and was the highest grossing film of 1990. And in many ways, it remains a pop cultural phenomenon, hence Molly, You and Danger Girl, which remains a catchphrase in pop culture.
I love it. I love it.
Even though Ghost received a mixed reaction from critics, it was nominated for 5 Oscars, including Best Picture, and it won 2. Best Supporting Actress for Whoopi Goldberg, starting her road to her EGOT, and Best Original Screenplay for Bruce Joel Rubin. So Ghost is the story of Sam, played by Swayze, and Molly, Demi Moore. He's a finance guy. She's a quirky artist. They've just moved in together to this massive Soho loft that they've renovated, which is filled with wacky statues, because she is obviously a quirky artist. So Molly and Sam really enjoy sensually making pottery in the middle of the night while listening to the Righteous Brothers. Everyone knows this iconic scene. They are so in love. And one night while walking home from the theater, Molly impulsively proposes to Sam.
I want to marry you, Sam.
What? What?
Yep. I've been thinking about it. I'm thinking about it a lot. And I think we should just do it.
Right before they're mugged at gunpoint.
What do you want?
Shit.
Your wallet. Give it.
Sam, who carries sensitive banking codes in his wallet, fights off the attacker. The gun goes off. The mugger runs, and Molly is left in the street, covered in blood, cradling Sam's body. But Sam is very confused as he's walking around, calling for help. But that is, of course, his ghost. Even though the white light is beckoning him to heaven, Molly begs him to stay, and so he does, even though she doesn't know that he's still there. So Sam follows the murderer. He finds out the guy's name is Willie Lopez, and that he was hired to steal Sam's wallet and that he killed him accidentally. But searching for help and a way to warn Molly about this guy who's going to go back to the apartment, he ends up at the storefront of the spiritual advisor Oda Mae Brown, played by Whoopi Goldberg. She is a fake psychic, but somehow she can hear Sam.
Listen, damn it. You are going to help me. There's a woman. Her name is Molly Jensen, and she's in terrible danger. The man who killed me broke into our apartment and he's gonna go back, so you've gotta warn her.
So he pleads with her and eventually annoys her into going to Soho to warn Molly about Willie Lopez. Molly is very skeptical, but Oda Mae knows so many intimate details about their relationship that she believes her.
Hey Molly, I know about the green underwear that you wrote your name on.
I'd never get over that, I'll tell you that.
So Sam ends up following Carl to Willie's apartment, and he's horrified to discover that his friend was the one who hired Willie to mug Sam.
She knows about the murder. And I want you to find this bitch, whoever she is. And I want you to just get rid of her, okay?
Carl is involved with these drug dealers who he's laundering money for, and he's trying to steal these bank codes from Sam, and he has this fake account set up. And now he's really worried about being caught. He's worried about Oda Mae. And now Oda Mae, you and Danger Girl. Sam learns how to move objects with energy, as we were discussing, from this very scary subway ghost. And he starts to formulate a plan to get revenge on Carl and protect the women. He uses Oda Mae to pose as the owner of the fraudulent bank account.
Rita, it looks like you'll be withdrawing $4 million from us today.
$4 million?
Say yes. Say yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. That's correct.
Easy.
And he has her close this account before Carl can transfer the money. They donate the $4 million check to some nuns. When the desperate Carl realizes that Sam's ghost is enacting revenge on him as Sam is typing threatening messages to him on this computer.
Sam.
Murder. He goes to Molly, who's reveals that Oda Mae had closed the account. Carl and Willie go after Oda Mae. Sam tries to protect her. Willie flees into the street. He's hit by a car.
You're dead, Willie.
He turns into a ghost that is dragged to hell by some scary, scary looking ghosts.
Bad shadows.
Yeah. Then Carl shows up. There's a violent attack. Sam ends up swinging a hook that shatters a pane of glass that impales Carl. Carl's ghost is also dragged to hell. And then finally, the ordeal is over. Sam and Molly are able to let go. They say their final goodbyes and their I love yous.
I love you, Molly. I've always loved you.
Ditto.
and he goes into the white light. It's very emotional and sad. Lots of crying. Demi Moore's amazing crying is on display.
It ends in like a Close Encounters cocoon, sort of glowy orb people coming and surrounding. Very E.T. Like there's a lot of 80s influence at that end shot.
But I did want to talk to you about like your film and how it relates to the afterlife and the way that you sort of came to this idea of doing a film about a relationship that is sort of being grappled with after like a very bad accident. And I don't want to give, you know, too many
We don't want to spoiler this away. One. Yeah, yeah. Well, so
but, you know, it is about like the, you know, this couple played by Sienna Miller and Diego Luna are in a bad car accident. And then the film sort of takes place in this time where you're like, I'm not really sure if they're both dead, if one of them's dead or what's happening here, if they're both alive and she's just having kind of like a mental sort of moment where she's like not sure what's going on, but their relationship is sort of being grappled with through all of these memories, and you have intertwined all of these moments of their life together. So I'm so curious, like, what did that look like on the page and the writing process of getting to that point?
Yeah. So in terms of the process, so the inspiration for the idea about 7 years ago, my husband and I we survived a pretty bad car crash. And
wow.
I like blacked out right on impact. And when I came to, I didn't know what was happening, but I couldn't see. So I just kept saying, I can't see. Like I was so pissed that he wasn't answering me. I was like, bro, I can't see, you know? And he sort of eked out, I can't breathe. And I just thought, oh my God, like we're screwed. So there was something in that moment for me where not knowing if I was dead or alive, not knowing, I felt like I was sort of like living out some weird Irish folk song, like dark Irish folk song that my mother used to sing to me or something like, but just having no sense that there could possibly be something wrong with him, that like he was like my rock. And then as soon as I thought there was something wrong with him, then it was like, oh no. You know, it was like one thing for me to be hurt, but another thing for him to be hurt. And then sort of coming out of that, like a few days later, I was on my couch at the house and I couldn't look at anything. I was super concussed. It just like any sort of information was too much for my head. And I was calling to my daughter, and there's a scene in the movie that plays this out, that Adrienne is calling to her baby. And she just was ignoring me. She's 6 months old. She's a baby. But for me in this confused state, I just very clearly thought for a minute, oh my God, I died. And I'm just witnessing what came after. And my mom will raise our kids and we'll never move into the house we just bought. And it just felt so anticlimactic, you know, like unpoetic, unsatisfied. It just felt so brutal for that to have been the end. And I think being a parent really changed my sense of my mortality too. So even further coming out of that, we were at Thanksgiving and everybody's fighting and crying and it was just chaos. And I just was really struck with this overwhelming sense of gratitude for these messy, delicate little lives that we were still lucky enough to be living. And it was like a few weeks later, I mean, I wanted to share that feeling. Like I knew like, oh my God, this feeling feels so essential and so right and so important. And I know I'm not going to remember it. Like, you know, it's like, this is like fleeting, this like sense of clarity. And a few months later, I think I woke up like in the middle of the night, like with a clean beginning, middle and end of a story about a couple who was struggling in like the first year of their kid's life and was on the verge of splitting up when this thing happened. And the woman thought she died and the husband was going to tell her their story to make sense of her head. And then it would be a series of them sort of going back through their memories and their disagreements about what happened, like in real time. And that they would fall back in love sort of in the process of that. And so that was, I mean, it was like really clear in my head, like how it would all mark out. And then it was a lot of time not writing, you know, like I think I was, you know, we were still like, we were kind of financially struggling because we had bought this house and had this accident, couldn't work. And I was struggling to get work as a director and I still had two little kids and I couldn't pay the nanny. And so there's like these big chunks of time that went by where I didn't have time or the means to be doing the work. And then I sort of hard to remember, like, I think I used some note cards at some point and I made like a 1-page treatment and then I expanded it out to a 12-page treatment. And I had pitched it to a few people who were like, we don't get it. And then I was feeling kind of sorry for myself. I was like doing these low budget Lifetime co-pros and couldn't, like I said, like couldn't afford to pay the nanny on sort of what I was making, and was feeling like making moves is so hard. And I'd gotten through this car accident situation and felt very much like life is short and my voice is essential and I have to use it now while I'm here. And so I quit doing like all those Lifetime movies, put us further into debt, and took time to write the script. And that process was actually pretty fast for me. Like I do the bulk of the heavy lifting and the pain and all the struggle in my treatments. And then once I write, I like to really just be in a zone and go like start to finish and try not to look back. And then it gets painful again in the rewrite process, you know? And then, but yeah, so that was sort of the, and I really was interested, I think, in what I wanted to explore was this sort of unreliability of my own head in that concussed state. And then we'd also lost a lot of people, family and some friends in that, or like around that time. And so I was sort of also interested in the psychosis of grief and how your mind protects yourself from trauma. And you know, I was reading, I read right before we started production, Joan Didion's A Year of Magical Thinking, and felt very pleased that some of the things that I was interested in was also what she was talking about. I was like, okay, I'm not totally crazy. Like if Joan Didion is talking about it, it's like a good sign. But when her husband passed, she talked about how they said, you know, would it be okay if we did an autopsy? And her first thought was, well, of course, because then you can figure out what's wrong and bring him back, you know, and fix him, right? And so there's this sort of childish thought process that goes through our minds, I think, when we're in deep trauma, and everyone just accepts it. It's like, well, you're just sad right now. You know, like you accept that psychosis for that time. And then the third thing was the loss of love and how traumatic that can be, you know, like a long-term relationship that's splitting up and how full of grief that can feel and how confusing and how you don't know which way is up sometimes. And I think, you know, I've been with my husband for 20 years, long, long, long time. And it's not always like, oh, of course, we're perfect together and we will always be perfect together. It's, you know, it's peaks and valleys. And I think love can be very disorienting the same way that, you know, being a young mother for the first year of a child's life can be. So I was just sort of interested in all of those things and how they all felt like they met in this crazy Venn diagram.
Yeah. And I love that the way your film is structured, how they're having these discussions of their relationship that are sort of in the present, but that, but what's happening is in the past.
Right. Yeah. So they're like living out what happened and then they're sort of stopping in the middle of it to say, wait, no, that didn't happen that way. And they sort of talk to each other. Yeah. I mean, I definitely structurally wanted the exploration to be like not like a traditional hero's journey where a guy with sword goes on his adventure, which is very much like what Patrick Swayze is doing, to be honest. Then you go into the cave and it's also like male sexual and blah, 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 you know, and you come out like reborn. I wanted to do something that was more of a spiral. I'm like obsessed with the Fibonacci spiral. It's like the ratio of all things, right? Like a snail shell, the universe, your forearm to your arm. And also I think how time, you know, scientists say time actually unfurls in a spiral, not in a line, which makes a lot of sense. So there's a lot of that that I was interested in trying to explore.
Well, your film really evokes that sense of not just spiraling, but also memory and also being in that fog of whether it's you've been injured or concussed or whether you're going through like breakup psychosis, which I've fully gone through myself.
Yeah, totally. I like that breakup psychosis. I'm going to use that.
You know, I mean, I've been there.
Yeah.
and you don't know what's real and you don't know what to believe and all of that. And you're kind of pulling all the strands apart to say what happened and what was this memory and what was that memory. And your film is so evocative of that. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will talk more ghost.
Hi, I'm Joe Firestone.
And I'm Manolo Moreno.
And we host After Game Show, a podcast where listeners submit games, and we play them regardless of quality with a dozen listeners from around the world.
We've had folks call in from as far as Sweden, South Africa, and the Philippines.
Here's an example. This is a game we called Zooey Deschanel, where you turn a celebrity's name into an animal pun. You have an example, Manolo?
Brad Gorilla Pitt.
Oh, that's a pun on Gorilla Pitts?
Yep.
I don't know.
That's Brad Pitt.
Oh, okay.
That's a high-quality game that you could expect.
Dr. Game Show has new episodes every other Wednesday on Maximum Fun.
Check us out, please.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm Katie Walsh, and we are talking to Tara Mealy about Ghost and her film Wander Darkly. I wanted to talk a little bit about the casting because Sienna Miller and Diego Luna are so great. And also, I think, you know, the casting in Ghost is really important.
Yeah.
As I was kind of talking about what Patrick Swayze sort of embodies, at least for me, you know, you in that role of Sam, I think you need someone who is emotional, who is heroic, and who is, but he embodies like a sort of goodness, I think. And it's funny because I was looking at some of the people who were considered, and actually Patrick Swayze was not considered right away, and Jerry Zucker didn't want him.
What? Do tell. This is great intel.
I guess, like, you know, a lot of, like, what Patrick Swayze, like, he did Dirty Dancing, and then he was kind of typecast. And then he did, like, Roadhouse, which I love. But, you know, I think he was kind of in this weird, didn't really know, like, what, like, am I a dancer guy? And he is, you know, he's a ballet dancer, a trained ballet dancer. Or am I a, you know, am I roundhouse kicking, you know?
Yeah, guys. Right. Am I a stunt guy? Am I an action guy?
And I think, but like being able to be both is so rare in a way, and that he can be, you know, someone that you're like, yeah, I can imagine him beating someone up, but also he's emotional and doing the sensual pottery scene. So, but I was going to say that some of the people they considered before Patrick Swayze were, they considered Harrison Ford, who said, I've read this thing 3 times and I still don't get it.
Oh my God, I love it. By the way, it does feel a little bit like the otherworldly version of The Fugitive, right?
Yes.
Like a little bit.
They also considered Michael J. Fox, which I don't think would have worked. And
I mean, I love him and Back to the Future Forever, and we can do that at another time. We should just hang out and talk about that. But that does not make any sense. Like just imagining him in like a sex scene, like doesn't totally translate for me.
I know. I don't know if I'd be able to imagine that either, especially with Demi, but they would have had to cast someone else. And then they also considered Paul Hogan, which is crazy to me.
So it was like luck. It was like a real lucky thing for them that they got Patrick and that this became like, you know, relatable for women. Because if you think about it, like that, he's so like in touch with his like feminine side or his like, he's so emotionally intelligent that like it's easy to follow him as a protagonist, I think for women maybe, or whatever, for me. I'm just going to talk about me because I feel like women have their own. Everyone can have their own opinion. But yeah, that's fascinating. Paul Hogan. Jeez. Wow.
I know. They ended up, I guess, the screenwriter, Bruce Joel Rubin, saw Patrick Swayze doing an interview on Barbara Walters talking about his father's death. And he was so emotional and he cried. And he just, I think he realized that he was, you know, the person who could sort of embody that kind of emotional state for this character and be both things. So they are so lucky that they got him.
Okay, wait, I have to tell a story that I've never told about Diego. So when we were starting to talk about who was going to play this part, first of all, Diego was in my lookbook like early on. He takes up like a quarter of the page about that character. So that was just, it was always his. But I saw this interview with him after the earthquakes that had happened in Mexico City. And he literally had been in the streets pulling people out of like, you know, buildings that had fallen. It was like super intense, but he was able to somehow bring this light to it and this humor to it. And like, he was making, you know, jokes that were just about like survival of humanity. And like, he just was so clearly a good person and had this certain kind of perspective that I felt like was Mateo, like at his core. And I was like, oh, of course it's him. Like it always was. And of course it's him. So on top of the fact that I just think he's phenomenal and an incredible actor, that was sort of the thing that I was like, oh yeah, it's right there.
That's so interesting because it means that you're picking up on some, on who they are as a person in the same way that Bruce Joel Rubin was picking up on, you know, something inherent in Patrick Swayze and his ability to access emotions. Yeah. And you saw that in Diego himself. And yeah. I can kind of understand what you mean in that he's bringing a lightness. Like, he almost has like, not just in this movie necessarily, but like in general, I feel like he has like a sort of playfulness to his
like a
energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like and he says it in the movie, and I think he shares this trait with my husband in some ways, a sort of boyish charm.
Yeah.
But it's not flippant. It's not like a callous, careless, thoughtless, boyish charm. It's contrasted and supported by like a deep intelligence and curiosity. And like, and that's the thing that's so interesting. Like, he's so bright and so thoughtful and also has the sense of boyishness and charming, mm-hmm. you know, this charming nature, which I think is like quite amazing and really special, actually.
And then in terms of casting Sienna, was she always someone mm-hmm. that you had in mind, or was she someone that you arrived at?
Yeah. So Sienna got the script because she and Diego share an agent. So it was slipped to her. And look, I don't think it was like my first instinct to, when looking at who would play me, to cast like the most beautiful woman in the world, you know? So that wasn't like, oh, immediately I was like, Sienna Miller.
You're like, she must play me.
Of course. Hello. But I am like I've always been very fond of her and a big fan of her work. And, was very excited when I found out that she was like calling our producers and like lobbying for herself. Like, that was very exciting. And we got on a call, we had like a FaceTime, and she was so like, she just, first of all, she truly, really understood it. She like deeply understood this character and deeply responded to the story in a really personal way. And on top of which, she had never done anything like this before. And she was so down for like the raw sort of run and gun indie, like no makeup, like this is how I want to do this. She was just so game for it. And I thought like that she would be an incredible partner. Like, she would go to the mat. And I have to say, first of all, she did. She gives this insanely beautiful performance, as does Diego. But, you know, Sienna in particular just had so much heavy lifting to do. And she just is a pro. Like, she always was there, always on time, always knew her stuff, like always delivered 110%. Like, and it was not easy for her, and she did it till the bitter end. I mean, like, our last shots were in the freezing cold ocean in November in, you know, the Pacific Ocean. It was not easy. It was very, very cold. And she was like, okay, let's go again. What do you need? Let's do it. Let's finish it right. You know? So I feel really lucky to have worked with them.
She's such a, like, she's such an interesting actress. And I think in the past couple of years, she's been making some really fascinating choices and giving mm-hmm. some of the best performances that I've ever seen her do, especially in indie films like American Woman and Wander Darkly. It's just like, she is really going there and accessing parts of herself that I don't think that we have necessarily seen from her on screen. And I think she brings a lot of like power to this role. I think if you have someone like Diego, you kind of need someone to like a strong woman to like counterbalance that in a way.
Yeah. And their dynamic ended up being that on set as well. Like, he, you know, she needed to be untethered. She needed to be really unmoored and was sort of in this concussed state even while we were shooting. It just kind of crawled into her skin. So she was quite uncomfortable like the whole time we were shooting and sort of unsure like what was happening the whole time we were shooting. In order to make that work, Diego ended up being like this rock and this anchor and this sort of like solid mass for her to hold on to and to like keep touching back to. And it works that way on film too, you know, like they play that dynamic out. I also think the work has changed to give Sienna something to do. So like, I remember one year where like there were a few Academy screeners where Sienna was like a wife who was crying about a guy who, it was his story. And I was like really frustrated that year. I remember thinking like, maybe I am just like a supporting character. Like, maybe women are just there to support men and they're the ones who do stuff. And like, my husband was like, you need to stop watching fucking movies. because it really does affect you where you see your place in the world. So I think the work has changed around her. So she's been given opportunities to show what she's capable of. And then I think on this movie in particular, like, we had so many conversations when I was casting and hiring Keys that it was about a human story. It was not like a woman story. We were not supposed to like, you know, like fall in love with her in the frame. We should shoot her like we would shoot a man. We should give her the respect that we would give a man on that frame. And she doesn't need mascara to make her eyes pop. She doesn't need like, you know, foundation to make sure her skin is even. Like whatever we would be doing for, I kept saying Benicio del Toro, but like whatever we would be doing for that guy to support his performance is the same sort of thing we should do for her. So like, don't get so precious about the way she looks. Don't be so careful about the way she's presented, and like, don't pedestal her, like take her into a human level so that we can access her. And so we can experience this with her. We had to be completely with her. And that was in editing. And I mean, every, you know, like across the board, we're constantly talking about that.
Yeah. That's so fascinating to, I haven't heard that necessarily put that way, where it's like, we need to do what we can to support the performance and the performer. And that doesn't necessarily mean making sure they have a perfect blowout or.
Yes. Yeah.
That always takes me out of a film when I'm like, when did she get her hair done?
Yes, totally. That like that CW, like yes. Gentle curl. I'm like
who has time? So nice. I've never achieved a beachy wave in my life. So, you know, who has the time, especially in a movie that is this emotional and this much about grief and, reckoning and an emotional journey that these people go on.
Even like trusting your actress that like they have a process, that they're in their process, that like, you know, I always hear these stories about like directors who've like yelled at their actress, and isn't that testament that the director was actually getting the performance? And I'm like, I don't know. I think if you put up those directors' movies and you see all the bad performances that have happened, maybe you would actually give the woman credit for the performance that she gave.
Right. Despite,
yes.
What she
whoever
went through.
Screaming at her. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will talk more Ghost with Tara Mealy.
Hey, I'm Jared Hill, co-host of the brand new Maximum Fun podcast, Fantime.
And I'm Travelle Anderson. I'm the other more fabulous co-host. And the reason you really should be tuning in.
I feel the nausea rising.
To be Fanti is to be a big fan of something, but also have some challenging or anti feelings toward it.
Kind of like Kanye.
We're all fans of Kanye. He's a musical genius, but like, you know.
He thinks slavery is a choice.
Or like the Real Housewives of Atlanta. Like, I love the drama, but do I want to see black women fighting each other on screen?
Ew. To the nah.
We're tackling all of those complex and complicated conversations about the people, places, and things that we love.
Even though they may not love us back.
Fanti, Maximum Fun, podcast.
Ow.
Okay, we are back, Switchblade Sisters, with Tara Mealy, the director of Wander Darkly, and we are talking about Ghost, the 1990 film, which we have both rediscovered this week and are like, this movie is great. in terms of setting, like, I love that your film was set in LA and Mexico. I mean, did you always want to have those Mexico scenes, even if you hadn't cast Diego, or... were you always considering like a Mexican actor for that aspect of the story?
So, you know, it was sort of an evolution. So early on, it wasn't Mexico. It was like a trip to Bali that they had taken, and he was not Latino in the very, very first draft. But I had wanted to cast a diverse actor. I just felt like that felt like the right thing to do. Like where we live in LA is incredibly diverse, you know, like it just felt like the right thing to do for that character. And so, it was pretty shortly after that. I think it was like the second or third draft or something that it became, I mean, Day of the Dead was always in there. It was always on the east side of LA. And then it just felt natural that it should be like a Latino, like a, you know, a Mexican American actor. And Diego was the first person we sent that version of the script to. Yeah. So, and it did change to Mexico, and that seemed like more doable and more, you know, possible. Mm-hmm. In our budget, there was even a version where there were no dolphins and there was no, it was like a hike in, you know, like Laurel Canyon or something. Mm-hmm. So I think there's always sort of like that little shuffle of what if there could be, but that was something that was really hard to lose. I just felt like the other thing too, you know, around the time when we were like out and casting and developing this was when a lot of the problems at the border were on the news. And I felt like it wouldn't be bad for an audience to identify and have empathy with a Mexican American man. Mm-hmm. and see them as just a, a person in a relationship in a life, like in America, mm-hmm. you know?
Also, as an Angeleno, I appreciate that you have the scene that is set in the homeless camp. And with that character who ultimately becomes like a very pivotal character. And, you know, we don't have to talk about plot points, but I'm like, that's the city I live in.
It's the city I live in. Yeah, it's so funny. I didn't think that much about it. After our accident, somebody did run over to the car and ask if we were okay and asked if the kids were in the car. And I like threw up with the idea of that. They were not in the car. But definitely it's just everywhere all the time, mm-hmm. you know? And I think, again, it's about humanizing mm-hmm. what's around us and the difficult situations that are around us. And, you know, just the interconnectivity of all of us, that like, that we all are a part of each other's lives, that there's not a way to avoid that truth, you know?
It's a very humanizing scene. And I really appreciated your treatment of that and making it, you know, these are the people who live around us, our unhoused neighbors, and they're a part of our community as well. And, you know, I do think when you look at Ghost and you think about someone like Willie Lopez, it's like, oh, it's a little bit problematic.
A little bit problematic. Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, I guess that was just the time that we kind of have to, you know, there are certain things we have to just say, oh, that was 1990 for you.
Well, and it's interesting, like I've even had this problem, like, you know, like I've shot some action TV shows. Mm-hmm. And so if you have like white leads and you're trying to cast diversity, then what happens is you come in as a guest director and the roles that are diversity are like the bad guys. Mm-hmm. So then you're like, okay, so do I cast like a person of color in this role as the bad guy, or do I just cast a white guy because I don't want to cast a person of color as the bad guy? And like, it's you know, it has to be changed in other directions. It has to be like, first we lead with diversity and then we fill in, you know what I mean? Like it can't be like, oh, we're only casting diversity from like number four down on the call sheet, because then it ends up being,
Any final thoughts on Ghost and what its impact has been either on your work or just the world in general?
Totally. I will just say that I think in like the 80s and early 90s, there were so many movies about ghosts. Like
True.
In my childhood, it was like from Poltergeist to Ghost to maybe Cocoon is more about aliens. I can't remember that well, but like Ghostbusters, you know, like there was just so much about that, like that perspective on the afterlife, that I'm sure it like crawled into my skin in some very fundamental way and affected, you know, me wanting to do this, wanting to do Wander Darkly. So it was really fun to go back and watch it after having not watched it since I was 10 or whatever, and appreciating its deep DNA influence on me. It was a core building block, apparently.
Yeah, you know, I'm wondering if you said that some people read your script and were sort of like, we don't get it. Like, did you have any pushback on like wanting to do a film that like touches on supernatural ideas or the afterlife?
I do remember we were in a meeting with two like really amazing producers, and we started talking about experiences we had had, like if we'd ever had an experience where we thought we'd had like some sort of ghost experience. And Lynette Hal Taylor and I, Lynette's from England and I'm from back East. And we just start going on and on and on and on about like all the crazy weird stories and whether or not you believe it, who cares, but these weird things did happen. And our producer Sam is like I could feel her energy being like, you fucking maniac, stop talking about this stuff. Don't tell the financiers you believe in ghosts. Don't tell the financiers you believe in ghosts. And so it was an interesting moment there. But I don't really care what you call it. Like, it's human experience,
right?
Whatever we're experiencing, whether you're calling it, you know, mania or psychosis or a ghost experience, or I don't know what you want to call it, but like it all ends up to the same thing. You're having this experience. It's real for you. And that I'm really interested in that sort of internal journey and that what our brains are doing to us to help us process and call it a dream or, you know.
So I do have one quote from Swayze, which he, you know, was talking about the film years later. And I think it's applicable to what we've been talking about. And I think it's applicable to your film, but he said, Ghost was about living your life for the moment because that's all you've got. If you don't communicate with the people you love, you set yourself up for incredible pain if you lose them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly what that film is about, and what your film is about, and like what we've been talking about, just this idea of like being present with the people that you love and communicating with them and like making sure that everything that needs to be said has been said.
Totally. I love that. Look, I think there's like an earnestness about Ghost.
Yes.
That we, you know, jaded cynics hate to kind of buy into. You know, there's like a simplicity, like we're a rejection of the simplicity of that idea of what Patrick Swayze said about having to love people and tell them you love them. It's just like, it's because it's hard. And mm-hmm. so people are like, ew, that's so stupid. That's so simple. Wouldn't it be nice if life was that simple? And you're like, well, it might be. Like, joy might be that simple. And I think Wander Darkly suffers like a little bit of the same funny, like people who connect to it in such a deep, profound way and mm-hmm. like fall crying into my arms. And people who resist it and like don't connect to it, like hate it, like really get like angry about it. And I find it really fascinating. It's like a good Rorschach test, you know? It's like,
yeah, I think, you know, one of the hardest things to do, and I think one of the hardest, especially also like in cinema, like either you telling a story or you relating to a story is sincerity and earnestness. Mm-hmm. And that is such a like underrated quality, I think, even though that's what all storytelling is about, is like the stories that connect us and finding that emotional connection. And it requires sincerity and it requires earnestness on the part of the creator and the observer. So
yeah,
I don't know. I want to celebrate earnestness and sincerity a little bit more, especially now.
Especially now, like after all this, it's like, let's just have a moment of like, not the anti-hero. Like, let's not have like stories where we look at people like Trump and just enjoy how awful and evil they are. It's like, let's look at people who are good people trying to make the world work.
Absolutely. Well, Tara, it's been such a joy and pleasure talking to you about Ghost on this episode of Switchblade Sisters. Can you tell us where people can see Wander Darkly?
Yes, you can see it on Amazon and iTunes and wherever you stream your movies. And, you know, you can also rate it and review it if you're so inclined when you're done.
So thank you so much for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you'd like to tell us what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien, our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Molly, you in danger, girl.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned, audience supported.